and we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and classical music on your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm very excited today to be meeting for the first time and introducing to all of you one of Kenosha's great musical sons. And there's actually a number of notable musicians who have come from Kenosha. And one of them is Chester Biscardi. He grew up in a wonderful Italian-American family right here in Kenosha, graduated, went on to college, and has gone on from there to a really fine career as a musician and composer, and heads up the music department at Sarah Lawrence College. And he is back in his hometown, visiting family and friends, and getting reacquainted with this this place that he still calls home. And we're going to be talking with him about his career as a composer, and what has inspired him to write the music which he has created over the years. Joining us is Dr. Richard Sjerdsma, recently retired as a voice teacher and chair of the music department at Carthage College. And the story of how the two of them eventually crossed paths and came to know each other is an interesting one, one of several stories that we'll tell through the course of the hour. And Mr. Biscardi's brought with him several different compact disc recordings which feature some of his really striking music. And so it's great to have Mozart right in the room to be able to talk a little bit about what inspired various pieces which he has created over all these years. So, Chester Biscardi, we welcome you to the morning show and back to Kenosha.
Good morning, Greg. Thank you for having me here. And hi, Dick. Nice to see you again.
Dr. Sjerdsma, good to have you here as well. Let's start off the bat with the story of your early years here in good old Kenosha, Wisconsin. And you were born, I believe, about 60 years ago.
Oh, unfortunately or fortunately, yes, in 1948, October 19th, 1948. Yes, I grew up here, and, Kenosha and Wisconsin in general in those days had an amazing music program. I think it had one of the best in the country, and unfortunately, I think all of those programs have gone the way of everything else, where they just, it's very hard for them to be supported anymore. But they had a great string program here, and when I was a little kid, they used to test you actually for your level of abilities in music, and I got something like 99 percentile, which is great. And they gave me a French horn because they needed French horn players at the time. And I remember the French horn was actually bigger than me. I'd go to Frank's school, grade school I went to, and dragging this instrument. And I got a cold, and I just cried, and I said, can I have a violin? It's easier to carry. So my father actually got me a three-quarters violin, and I started playing the violin, I think, when I was about 7. And started writing music when I was about 9, writing little pieces called, like, Happy and Sad, which I think are very telling.
Yeah,
with my music now, it's sort of this mix of sort of ebullience and kind of poignancy, actually.
Yeah, that's very well put. Now, your family, was it much of a musical family? I mean, were there other musicians on this family tree?
Well, actually, my father was a natural musician. He never studied music, but he played accordion by ear. And apparently during the Depression, when they didn't have, you know, potatoes in the house, they had 3 pianos. So my father just did that by himself. So there was that. But other than that, there really isn't any other person in my family who actually does music.
Hmm. So what are their earliest recollections of you even being interested in music? Was it sitting at the piano and plunking things out, or listening to music quite avidly?
I think mostly listening to music. We actually didn't have a piano when I was growing up. We had accordions in the house. And my brother Don, who I'm visiting right now, I know early on played the accordion a little bit. But I just think I just loved music, and when I was little, I'd always go to the Kenosha Public Library and, you know, take out records.
Hmm. Now, did you get to discard the French horn, or were you a double threat there?
No, I got rid of the French horn as soon as I could get rid of the French horn. No,
none of that heavy lifting for you.
What happened to me, I have two relatives, Virginia and Catherine Tenuta, who did have a piano in their home. So I would go over there maybe when I was about 6 or 7 and just sort of play on it. And they sort of taught me things little by little. So I learned how to play the piano from that point, but I mostly played the violin. But at a certain point when I was writing a lot of music, there was a woman, I think her name was Mrs. Peterson, who was out near Kemper Hall, and she headed the Junior Schubert Club. Is the Junior Schubert Club still?
There's a Schubert Club here. I'm not sure about the Junior Schubert Club, but...
Well, again, that was another thing for children. They had this Junior Schubert Club, and I went and I played my compositions, and Mrs. Peterson said to me, you know, if you want to be a composer, you really have to play the piano. Hmm. And I said, I don't think I have money to learn how to play the piano. And the next thing I knew was I had an arrangement to study piano with Margaret Schmidt, who was a wonderful piano teacher. She had a studio above the old Bittinger's in Midtown. So I was studying with her. This was in junior high school, basically. I studied piano with her. But the lessons were being paid for by an anonymous donor, a woman who did not want to be known to me. And when I graduated from high school, from St. Joe's, and I went on to college to not do music, by the way, because of my family thought I should really be a lawyer and a politician. I wrote a letter to her, and I addressed it, Dear Madame von Meck, because Madame von Meck was Tchaikovsky's patroness. And I thanked her, and she sent me some cufflinks and a $20 bill at Christmas time. But it wasn't until, I don't know what it's, a number of years ago now, maybe 10, 15 years, I was home visiting family, and I told this story to the Kenosha News. And this woman came forward, and unfortunately at this particular moment I can't remember her name, but she decided she wanted me to know who she was. And it was an amazing, she was dying of cancer at the time, and it was an amazing kind of meeting.
Can you tell us a little bit about what prompted her to make this gesture? I mean, had she seen you or met you or heard some of your music? Or?
I think it was simply by word of this Mrs. Peterson, who said there's this young composer who really needs to learn how to play the piano, and he doesn't have any money, really. So, you know, is there a way of helping him out? And I think she helped other people do other things.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a great legacy. That's neat. What was it that you think prompted your first attempts to compose your own music? That strikes me as a big step for a young musician to take. I mean, you can be a very, very gifted prodigy, but that doesn't necessarily mean you're tempted to create your own music. Did anything in particular inspire you to give that a try?
What was the original impetus? I have actually no idea. That's a really interesting question. I just did it. It was part of the nature of what I did. I practiced the violin for 20 minutes a day, got bored with that, and then took out some manuscript paper and started writing things down. At one point, I remember I made an arrangement, a transcription, of the first movement of the Brahms First Symphony for solo violin. I must have been 8. I mean, what did I know that, you know, it's an orchestra piece. How do you actually reduce an orchestra piece to a solo violin piece? But that I remember that.
Huh.
And I remember being impassioned by the fact of Wisconsin statehood, which was 1848, I think. So I wrote a piano concerto. I must have been 11 for string orchestra and piano.
In honor of Wisconsin statehood.
In honor of Wisconsin. Huh. And I wrote a series of short piano pieces in memory, I think in memoir. They were dedicated to my mom in Memoir of a Summer that were very Gershwin-esque, which brings up an important point. When I was really young, my hero was George Gershwin. I mean, there was no question about it. George Gershwin, Aaron Copland, I mean, these were really the people who were my early mentors in the sense of inspiration. And I have to say, I have to thank the Kenosha Public Library, Library Park. I mean, I used to get on my bicycle. One of the things I loved to do, we lived in Midtown. I would ride my bike down and just sit on Lake Michigan and look at the lake. There was something I found great solace in doing that. And then I'd go to the library and just check things out, see what the new LPs were, and bring them home. I was like 12 years old. That's what I would do, and listen to them. And a lot of them were George Gershwin. A lot of them were musicals. I love the American musical. Was my desire to write the next great American musical. It's still my desire to write the next great musical. So, you know, these were my inspirations.
This might be a good point for us to actually listen to a little music from your pen, although obviously this is going to jump us a little bit ahead in the timeline, but I think people are anxious to, if they've not heard the music of Chester Biscardi, to hear something. And why don't
we talk about this a little bit, though?
Absolutely. First? Sure, absolutely. So you were just saying that early on, one of your great aspirations was to write the great American musical, which you have not really attempted, but you have written at least one opera.
I have. And this is Tightrope, and was commissioned by the University of Wisconsin for its 90th anniversary in 1985, as well as the they had just taken their constructed a chamber opera house there, and beautiful, beautiful, beautiful gem of a place, acoustically and in every possible way. And this was really quite an honor. I think it was the first American university to commission an opera. I worked at the time. I went and saw numerous people like Aaron Copland, Virgil Thompson, Ned Roram, talked to them about the nature of writing opera. How do I find a librettist, which is a rare bird? And all fingers pointed to a man by the name of Henry Butler, who was living in Graz, Austria at the time. He's a friend of Richard Miller, actually, we were talking about him.
Oh, yeah.
And got in touch with him, and we came up with an idea, an original idea. This is not based on anything. It's the story of a poet who is supposedly dead by the name of Luther Dane, and a film biography is being made about his life. A young actor is on stage making the opera, and he's in the middle of his opening sequence, and he says, excuse me, can we break? Because, you know, I read this guy's poetry. I saw him when he spoke. He was amazing. This is not the man that you say he was. And the director comes and says, well, you're a pretty interesting young actor. Let's, you know, just cool it down and, you know, take a break. And as they take a break and everybody leaves the stage, the poet comes on stage and he says, I'm not dead. I know they've made a statue to me. I know I've become a legend. But let me tell you, if you're really interested in who I am, what my life was like and why I made the choices I needed to make creatively and otherwise. And basically he tells him his life as a poet, being caught up by critics, by early loves, by people who just really wanted pieces of him, and he didn't want to give that to him, and he couldn't get on the tightrope to walk to really make that balancing act work between the creative artist and human being. And he wanted this young actor to know that, and at the end he disappears again, with the young actor being left with, who was this guy? How can I be a different person? Now, what's amazing about this production was, when I was a little kid in Kenosha and getting these records out of the public library, one of them was On the Town by Leonard Bernstein and Compton and Green. Amazing, amazing musical. And one of the stars of that was John Reardon. John Reardon sang a song in that show called Lucky to Be Me. I cry now, actually, because it was, for a young kid to hear that, it was an amazing experience. It was so beautiful, and it had everything to do with something outside of oneself, finding a new life. And to me, New York was sort of the mecca of what one needed to do. I don't know why it is some people grow up, and when they're kids, they just need to go to New York. So that was sort of my fantasy. Anyway, it ends up that John Reardon has the lead in my opera, which was an extraordinary experience.
A dream come true for you.
So what this aria is, you have two characters. The actor, it's played by Marcus Haddock, who is a really very well-known young tenor at this point, and John Reardon, this was his last role, actually, before he passed away. And it's a moment where they meet, and the young actor's saying, you know, you can get back on the tightrope. You said you could. And he says, I don't want to. But he remembers what it's like to be a young poet and a young man.
Here it is, and this is from one of those first performances of the opera.
The performance of Tightrope in 1985.
And we will hear the beautiful bass baritone voice of John Reardon.
We walk a tightrope, one false step, one dishonest word, and we fall. We deserve to fall. I had forgotten such sincerity. My memory is good, I will make it accurate, and there are witnesses. intend to be a poet. No one, no one does. The title has no meaning, and the profession less. Day after day, the words and pictures made me drunk, jumbling through my head, demanding that I give them order. And that order is called poetry. I found a voice to comfort me as no one could. I found an ear that heard me, no matter how corrupt or frightened I might. Most wonderful, I found a way to praise the utter beauty of everything I saw. The faces, the colors of the air, everything that grows and reaches for the sun.
Truly wonderful moment, gosh, from the opera Tightrope by our morning show guest Chester Biscardi, and some magnificent singing from John Reardon. I can scarcely imagine what that had to feel like for you to sit in the audience for that performance.
It was pretty amazing, actually. It was such a privilege to work with him. I mean, the whole cast for that show, the principal cast, was quite extraordinary. One of his early loves, Sarah, was played by Susan Powell, who was a Miss America in 1981, and a fabulous singer, actually. A more mature love, Catherine, was played by Audrea Firestone, who was then singing Carmen at the New York City Opera. And this young, unknown tenor, Marcus Haddix, who is very well known now. I mean, he's really got an extraordinary career, so it's a great thing.
Wow. Now, let's backtrack for just a moment. When you went off to, you graduated from St. Joseph's High School in 1966, I think.
Yep.
And you went off to the University of Wisconsin-Madison, but not to be a music major. I'm just trying to imagine what that would feel like to obviously be...
Yeah.
Totally taken up with music and yet being directed parentally in another direction.
Well, I mean, parentally, and I think even by self, in the sense of, like, you know, how does one prepare for a life and what do you do? And I had always been interested in I was student council president at St. Joe's, so I was always interested in leadership type things. So that made sense that I was going to go into a pre-law type program. But I do remember being 17 and standing on Bascom Hill between the law school and what then became the Opera House, because that used to be, I forgot what it was called before that, it was used by the music program, but it wasn't the Opera House, and standing between the two things and thinking, like, what do I do? And I actually went to see Paul Badura Skoda, who is famous Viennese pianist, who is a pianist in residence, and he was actually in one of the rooms of what became the Opera House, and I showed him this piano concerto, you know, Wisconsin 1848. And he said, you know, you should really, you know, listen to your parents and become, you know, a lawyer and keep music as an avocation.
Oh, dear.
So I thought, well, the great artist said so, so that's what I need to do. It was great, I have to tell you, when the opera went up in that space thinking, like, I got revenge.
Yeah, really. So what pulled you back towards music then? Anything in particular? I mean, and I guess maybe we should clarify, too, I suspect it's not that you shut music entirely out of your life, but
no.
At some point it became front and center again.
But I have to tell you, though, that in a way it's a happy accident that it happened this way, because although I started in pre-law, I was really interested in literature, and I did a lot of work in English literature and some honors programs in that, and started studying Italian language and literature. And again, you know, sort of the immigrant feeling back then was, you know, a lot of Italians came to the United States, and they really wanted their children to be American and not to really learn languages. So I was never taught Italian. So when I went to the University of Wisconsin, I started taking it, and ended up with this sort of like English-Italian literature background. And then I went to Bologna, Italy, my senior year, instead of going to law school, which I had been accepted to, and came back, and they offered me this thing to do a master's in Italian literature, which I did, and I finished all the work up through finishing the PhD dissertation in Italian when I started writing music again. And I showed this trio I'd written for flute, harpsichord, and violin to Les Thimmig, the resident composer up in Madison. And I said, what do you think of this? And he said, what are you doing in Italian literature? You're a composer. So I switched over into the music program there and then went on to Yale and got my doctorate, in short. But I have to tell you that all of the work I did in literature has been absolutely significant to the work I do in music, not only in the sense of, at this point, setting texts and the idea, the nuance of words and structure of poetry and whatever, but also kind of structures that literature suggested for music, not vocal music. I mean, for all of my early works, a piece that you mentioned before, this piano piece called Mestiere, which has an Italian title, Métier in French, or The Business of What You Do, is really a work that I wrote for the piano with what the piano did. I wrote a piece called Tenzone, which is it was a medieval exchange between poets. A poet would write something in a certain form and send it to a friend, and that friend would respond in the same form with his take on it. So I'm always dealing with literary conceits in a way, and that I am very happy to have gone through that stuff.
Maybe this is a good point to mention this, I mentioned this in the review of some of your music that I just wrote for the Journal of Singing that Dr. Schurzma edited, but I'm pretty sure I remark in there at some point about, here's this wonderfully well-read composer whose career and musical exploits have taken him all over the world, coming out of a city that we think of, you know, with brats, and I mean, it's a real blue-collar, very down-to-earth kind of community from which you spring. And in some ways, you know, what you describe is a career that has taken you far from here in more ways than one. What do you see as any lines of connection, besides the fact that Kenosha, of course, has this wonderful tradition in terms of music in its schools? Aside from that, do you carry any of the down-to-earthness of Kenosha into this life now that you lead?
Well, you know, that's completely true. In fact, I never really thought, and I don't still feel that kind of fact that it's this, you know, bratwurst, blue-collar sensibility here.
Yeah, I should say what I think I said in my column. I didn't say it just now. Is that that's the way the world
tends
to look at
Kenosha,
and there's, of course, much more to it than that.
No, hardly at all. I mean, the thing is that Kenosha actually has so many of, it's kind of like the right balance of things. And the, you know, what you said before of, you know, roots centering is something that I really got from growing up here. I mean, certainly my family, you know, starting with family, I mean, a really good Italian Catholic family with all the values that come with that was completely that way. When I was a little kid, I was very involved in church, Our Lady of Mount Carmel Church. I was an altar boy. I was student council president. There was certain, all of those kinds of things were possible here. And there was an amazing mixed community. community. I mean, there were people like Margaret Schmidt, the piano teacher, Margaret Peterson, people like that who really loved the arts. And I lived next door to a librarian by the name of Ellen Gagnon, and she was the children's librarian, I think, I can't remember the name, where the library was right now, but she was a painter, and she was a librarian. So that was kind of my background that I really carry from here.
Let's bring in Dr. Richard Sirdsma, who recently retired as chair of the music department at Carthage College and head of the voice department there for many years, and find out a little bit about how the two of you initially met. I had blithely assumed that it had something to do with you growing up here and you coming to Carthage, that in a sense doesn't have very much to do with it at all. You were two ships passing in the night.
First, let me say how excited I am to be here. It's great to hear the local color coming through out of this discussion. I'm not a native Kenoshan, but I've been here since 1968, so I feel like one, and it's just great getting all of this this background. And also, finally having the opportunity to meet Chet after, probably over a year of communication. As you mentioned, Greg, I'm the editor of the Journal of Singing, which is an international periodical for voice practitioners of all kinds, from otolaryngologists through voice scientists, voice teachers, performers, coaches, pianists, and the like. And about a year and a half ago, I was editing a regularly appearing column in the journal called Popular Song and Music Theater, and the piece was about composers of the Great American Songbook, that is, composers that were now very active in writing pieces of a more popular and music theater nature. Among those mentioned was a Chester Biscardi, and his birth date in Kenosha, Wisconsin, leaped off the page. I made a mental note to check this out a little bit further, because I found it might be interesting to feature this native son in some way in the journal. So I looked at his website, and then we got into email, and then very soon after that, telephone conversation. And he sent me some music and some CDs, and I was immediately won over. I was particularly enthralled with what I consider one of his masterworks. It's a song cycle called The Gift of Life, and I think that we might hear an excerpt of that later on. And then I began to take notes as I was listening. And I asked one of my other contributors of a column called New Directions if I might usurp her column in a later issue and write an article about Chet and his music myself, which I did, and it appeared in the in the May June Journal of Singing. During our correspondence, some other things that are really almost eerie came to light. Fairly early on, Chet told me that that his mother worked in food service at Carthage, and in fact, we did overlap. And last night at the home where Chet's staying, I saw a picture of his mother, and indeed the face does register with me. And speaking of where he's staying, if I may go on to this other little interesting tidbit, which elaborates the story a little bit further, I play tennis regularly with a group of guys on Thursday evenings, and after a match about 3 or 4 weeks ago, we were sitting in the lobby area having some sodas, and I was asked by one of my buddies, Al Bella, how retirement was going, and I explained as best I could that I was enjoying some things, and I hadn't even gotten around to some projects I had set for myself, one of which was learning Finale, a computer music writing program. Al responded by saying that that his wife's uncle was a composer and also and used Finale, that system, a lot. He was at Sarah Lawrence College, and I immediately stopped Al, and I said, I can furnish the man's name, and then the world is increasingly smaller. I didn't realize to what extent.
You're right.
That this was just an amazing, amazing coincidence. And Al told me that that when Chet was going to be in town, he'd be living with them for a few days, which is two blocks from where I live, and we got together and met last night for the first time. It was just an amazing set of coincidences.
Last night was the first time you've actually met?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Oh, for goodness sakes,
yeah.
Because for all you've conversed via telephone and email and so on, I just assumed some kind of face-to-face meeting had already occurred.
But it feels like we've known each other for a long time because of all this correspondence. So it was just the icing on the cake last night, really.
How wonderful. Absolutely wonderful.
By the way, this is at my niece's house, Dawn Bella, and the family I'm visiting here is my brother Don and his two sons, Don and John. So that's my immediate family.
I want to play the opening portion of this lovely work called The Gift of Life. And the opening is a setting of a truly exquisite poem by Emily Dickinson. Just ahead of that, say a brief word about what it feels like as a composer to take in hand a truly wonderful poem, which in a sense doesn't need any music to be musical, and yet, you know, when you feel drawn to a text like that and want to set it to music, what kinds of things do you think about to be true to those words?
Well, the first thing you said is really important, which is most great poetry really does not beg for music, because music is implicit in that poetry. And I think that that's one of the difficult things for most composers to deal with, because I feel you can't really disturb that musical line. So what kind of music can I bring to it, or what kind of perspective can I bring my own perspective and enrich it in a different way? So that's the first thing that comes to mind, by the way, with any text I take. And Dickinson, of course, is so well known, and she's so often set to music, that's always troublesome too, because then you run into comparing yourself to other composers. But this I found it was a perfect thing, because it's a poem written about just after Dickinson's mother has died, and Dickinson's mother was kind of far away from her, from Emily. She didn't she wasn't really close to her, and she was a mother in another tree, basically. And so the fact is that even though the mother was not present, the mother always takes care of her young. And so this is a kind of a true lullaby. And it was written for the birth of Arianna Tamar Goldsworthy, who in fact today celebrates her 18th birthday.
Oh my gosh.
And she's the daughter of Judith Bettina and James Goldsworthy, who sing this. So, and this opens up the gift of life.
It's truly beautiful, and here it is. This is the opening portion of this thing called The Gift of Life. The music is Chester Biscardi's, and the text, Emily Dickinson.
Thank you.
I really love that. I suspect that this is true, that maybe an important source of inspiration for you will be a given singer and their voice. I was given that advice some years ago by the great Alice Parker when she came to visit Carthage and Kenosha. It was my wife who actually got up the courage to ask her, what would be your advice for an aspiring young composer? And her advice was, find a choir or find somebody who would be interested to sing your music for free and write something for them with their voice or voices in your head, because, you know, chances are that'll hook into you more powerfully, as opposed to just writing something generically for the universe that everybody will love. And I suspect that plays out that way for many people, and probably for you with certain singers who are special to you.
No, that's absolutely true. And I think especially early on when you're trying to find your own voice, I mean different in the musical language voice, to really hear something by somebody who is really superb and somebody who you admire is really critical. I mean, just this is kind of related, but the sense of how I go about to compose, I need the physicality of sound. I need to be at a piano. I need to hear. I need the piano to be well tuned. I need it to really resonate. I need to connect deeply and viscerally with the music. I can't just kind of like think about it intellectually. There's some sort of system that I need to use, so that's as important with a performer as well. And when I go to hear a piece being performed for the first time and I'm at rehearsals, it's very interesting to me. I mean, yeah.
When you actually set about to write a piece of music, let's say you've been commissioned or something, or there's some specific project, how does it begin? Does it begin with the kind of proverbial noodling at the piano, or I mean, what's typically the first step for you?
If it's a commission for a specific performer, that's one thing. If it's also a commission for a specific format, that's another, or related. In other words, if it's for somebody specific, I want to really hear what they sound like, so I will research that pretty much in depth. If it's, for instance, I just finished writing, just had a premiere of a piano quintet, so I went out and listened to different piano quintets. I wanted to hear that. What's the conventional way of thinking about piano quintet writing? And then how was I not going to do that? What's the idea? What's the idea of the piece? Does it have an idea? Sometimes it takes me a long time of sketching out ideas before I arrive at a place where, oh, this is where this piece is going to go. This is what this piece is going to feel like. It takes a long time. You know, the best way I can explain for me the creative process, it's like somebody's delivered to my apartment in New York this gigantic piece of marble, and I'm given one of those insubstantial wooden toothpicks. Not even the round ones, you know, the ones that if you look at, they fall apart, and I start chipping away at this marble with it. That's the way it feels like to me. And eventually, if they want to come to me, the ideas come, and I start shaping them.
Are you a composer whose waste basket tends to be fairly full in terms of first drafts and failed attempts?
Yes, absolutely. And now, of course, it's computer files.
Right. And that delete button.
Yep.
I would like to presume to choose a favorite of mine, if that's okay,
absolutely,
from this CD called Songs and Encores, which features the same soprano we just heard, Judith Bettina, and her husband, James Goldsworthy, at the piano. And a song that I really love called Guru. And feel free to say whatever you like about this ahead of us listening to it.
Well, this is a very simple, small song. And it's based on a text by Guru, by Allen Ginsberg. It's what Ginsberg writes about best, about cityscapes and interior landscapes. And it was really written for her as an encore.
Here it is.
Disappears. It is the
among the many wonderful things about that song is the wonderful gift of understatement, which I think is not all modern composers fully embrace. You're now at a college, and in fact, I think are the chair of the music department, mm-hmm. Correct?
Right.
At Sarah Lawrence College. I keep wanting to say Sarah Marshall, like the inane movie which just came out. Sarah Lawrence College. Say just a word. I'm afraid our time is just about gone. A word about what it's like for you to work, presumably, with young musicians and maybe young aspiring composers as you once were.
Well, it's one of the things that I really, really love to do, and I spend a lot of time actually developing and working with programs for young composers because I think it's critical. That I think that part of the soul of who we are on this planet is needed to be kept going by the arts, and certainly music is one of the major ways of doing that. So at Sarah Lawrence, we have a great music program in New York as well as in many places abroad, in Paris and in Oxford and in Florence and in Cuba and in Devon and so on, where we really train young composers to find their voices, and that's what I love doing.
Very good. I imagine that through the course of this career, it is a special pleasure to connect with, well, people like Dick Schurzma, and to connect with musicians who lavish great care over the performance of your pieces. I mean, I'm sure that has to be a very rich part of this life.
Oh, it's an extraordinary thing, and it's a privilege, actually, to work with people on that level and to explore the possibilities of things. I do want to say that the relationship that has this love fest that's happened between Dick and me is quite an extraordinary thing. You know, people have dream articles in their minds, like, wouldn't it be nice that someone would actually understand my music and write about it in an articulate way for the rest of the world to see, oh yeah, well, Dick did that for me.
Mm. So that's like being on the cover of Time.
It is. It's just as good, if not better, actually.
Well, this has been a great pleasure for me to meet you at last and to hear some music which I had not heard before, and to certainly hear a lot of stories I hadn't heard yet about who you are and how you have come to be who you are. And we hope that the rest of your visit to Kenosha, your hometown, is a very, very pleasant one.
Thank you.
We're going to finish out with just a few couple minutes from Incitation to Desire.
That's it.
Am I saying that right?
Yeah.
A tango for piano. And Chester Biscardi, we thank you so much for joining us today on The Morning Show.
Thanks so much for having
and
me.
And Dick Schurzma, good to see you as well. Thank
pleasure.
You. It's a minute before 9 o'clock on WGTD. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we speak with a history professor from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside about his newest book, An Examination of the Motorcycle Industry in Japan, and what a contentious industry that has been over the years, and one which has seen some really dramatic and surprising changes. That's coming up tomorrow. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. A cloudy day ahead of us. Right now, the rain chance has been downgraded from what it originally was, but still a 50% chance of rain, especially this afternoon. A high of 67 degrees, cooler near the lake. Slight chance of light rain tonight, low of 51. A cloudy day tomorrow, and again, slight chance of an afternoon thunderstorm, high of 69 degrees. Then we warm up back into the 80s by Thursday. This is WGTD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. Good morning. It is 9 o'clock, and this is Morning Classics on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Jim Fleming. In this hour, we listen to the second Sibelius Symphony. Next hour, we have a Music from Wisconsin special with cellist Amit Peled and pianist Eli Kalman from the UW Oshkosh Music Hall in March of this year. And right now, a violin sonata by Beethoven. Gidon Kremer and Martha Argerich join forces to bring us the violin sonata number 2 in A major.